Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello, on the last day of the year 1900, an ecstatic British academic wrote to a friend, "I invented a new subject, which turned out to be all mathematics for the first time treated in its essence." The academic was Bertrand Russell, and he was referring to the draft of his book, The Principles of Mathematics, which he'd just completed. In this work, Russell sought to reduce mathematics to logic, and later he was to describe it as the highest point of his life, in his words, an intellectual honeymoon, such as I've never experienced before or since. Bertrand Russell's impact on philosophy was immense and far-reaching. He was a key founder of analytic philosophy, today the dominant philosophical tradition in the English-speaking world. His theory of descriptions is one of the most famous and important ideas in 20th century philosophy, but his influence extended beyond academia. His many appearances on the BBC made him a well-known figure, and he wrote several books aimed successfully at the general public. With me to discuss the ideas and life of Bertrand Russell are Professor A.C. Grayling, Master of the New College of the Humanities and a Supernumerary Fellow of St. Anne's College, Oxford, Mike Beeney, Professor of Philosophy at the University of York, and Hilary Graves, Lecturer in Philosophy and Fellow of Somerville College, Oxford. Anthony Grayling, Bertrand Russell was born in 1872 into an aristocratic family. Can you give us something of his background and his childhood?
Yes, he was a grandson of Lord John Russell, the man who saw the 1832 Reform Bill through Parliament, which was the beginning of partial democratisation of our Parliament. And his father and mother died when he was very young, so he was brought up by his grandparents in Pembroke Lodge in Richmond Park. It was a grace and favour house that Queen Victoria gave to his grandfather. And his grandfather died early too, so actually he was brought up by his rather puritanical Scottish grandmother, and that had a great influence on him, really. It meant that for quite a large part of the early half of his adult life, he was much under the influence of this Puritan outlook. And he had a brother 7 years older than himself, Frank, who became the second Earl Russell, and Frank was an influence too, because very importantly, he was the first person to introduce Bertrand Russell himself to mathematics.
And are we talking about a lonely childhood? Basically, are we talking about something in his childhood that impacted on his later work?
Oh yes, very much so. It was a very lonely childhood. He wrote in his autobiography that although he loved Richmond Park and the flowers that he saw blooming every spring, nevertheless, he felt acutely this loneliness, living in a household of very, very much older people. His brother had gone away to school, he himself remained at home, and it wasn't until he was in his late teens that he was put in amongst other children, really, when he went off to a crammer.
Why didn't they send him to school?
I think he was rather sensitive, rather intellectual youth, and not a particularly sporty one. His brother was a much more robust character.
He described as a significant moment in his life his first encounter with Euclidean geometry.
That's right. This happened at the age of 11, and he was introduced to it by his brother Frank. He was very puzzled by the fact that he was obliged to accept certain axioms without them being proved. And he asked his brother about this. He said, well, why can't we prove the basis of what we're doing here? And his brother said to him, nope, we've just got to accept them, otherwise we can't get on. The other important thing about his introduction to geometry was that his brother told him that the fifth proposition of Euclid was one that people found particularly difficult, and Bertrand himself didn't find it difficult. And he said in his autobiography, this was the first indication to me that I might have some intelligence.
Mike Beeney, he became a mathematics undergraduate in Cambridge in 1890. Mathematics, but then he focused on philosophy. Can you take us through the early Cambridge career?
Yes, so he studied mathematics for about 3 years, and then he switched to do moral sciences. And at the time, what was dominant in Britain, certainly in the last two decades of the 19th century, was a movement called British idealism, and that was the tradition which Russell first worked in philosophy. So idealism is the view that the realm of ideas, or the mental and physical world, is somehow more fundamental than the other realm, so in particular the material or physical world. And so idealism is often opposed to materialism, but actually what Russell gradually moved towards was a more realist view. And the realist is someone who believes that a particular object or realm of objects exists independently of us. If I wanted to draw a contrast between them, one could say that if the idealist in some broad sense thinks that the world is somehow shaped or determined by the mind, then the realist is someone who thinks that that the world is exists independently of us.
He struck up a friendship with G.E. Moore and then met an Italian philosopher, wasn't it, Pino? How did these influence him?
Right.
He was obviously open to influences very strongly, wasn't he?
Absolutely. So Moore was a year younger than Russell, and had actually started doing philosophy straight away rather than doing it, having first studied mathematics. And Russell himself said that in his rebellion against British idealism, it was Moore who led the way. And I think what Moore particularly disliked about British idealism, or idealism in general, was the sceptical implications that it had. So if we think of the world as somehow mediated through our ideas, or you think of the world as somehow shaped or formed by our mind, then you think, well, how do I know what the world's really like? How do I know that you and I actually see the world in the same way? So it looks like lots of sceptical implications follow if you're an idealist. And Moore in particular didn't like that. In fact, he spent most of his life trying to refute scepticism. And Russell also took that on board. Anthony's mentioned his love of Euclidean geometry. I mean, if you're wanting to find certainty anywhere, then the obvious place to look is mathematics. But at the same time, according to, at least as Russell read idealism, mathematics is full of contradictions and inconsistencies. And in fact, his first work was on the foundations of geometry.
Hilary Graves, he take the idea of mathematics on. He wrote two important mathematical works, The Principles of Mathematics, that published in 1903, and Principia Mathematica, published about a decade later. What was he aiming to achieve in these books? Is it possible to bring them both together?
Sure, I mean, they're definitely both part of the same project. What's bothering Russell here is the issue that Anthony already mentioned in the context of Russell's first encounter with geometry. So Russell looks at these fundamental axioms that are taken as the starting points for geometry, and he says, well, that's fine. I can see how if you accept that these things are true, then the rest of geometry follows from them. But how do we know that those axioms are true?
Can you give us an example of the basic axioms you're always looking at?
Sure, I mean, they're just things like, for any two points of space, there exists a straight line that connects those two points. And Russell's thinking, well, you can wave your hands and say that intuitively you can see that these things are true, but really I want to do better than that. This is mathematics. We're looking for certainty. I want proof here. And that sort of proof is not something that geometry can supply. And Russell then has the same experience when he goes on to look at arithmetic. So the arithmetic of Russell's time starts from these so-called piano axioms. So they are supposed to take as basic things like, for any natural number x, x plus 1 is also a natural number. And again, Russell's thinking, okay, I can see how if you accept those things as basic, we can get the rest of arithmetic therefrom. But how can we prove that those basic things are true? And Russell's response to this is to say, okay, I'm going to try not taking the fundamental axioms of the various branches of mathematics as basic. I'm going to try giving definitions of them in purely logical terms.
So the listeners might be surprised to hear that he took on 1 plus 1 equals 2 and examined that.
Mm. Indeed. Well, this is to do with the high degree of certainty that Russell wants. He thinks it's not good enough just to say, intuitively, this seems obvious. And we'll see that this fear is justified when we get onto the later parts of the story. But it's also justified by actual controversies that are going on in real mathematics at Russell's time. So he has real cases of 19th century mathematicians. You get two mathematicians around a table and they sit there and they look at the same proof that somebody's offered, and mathematician number one says, well, intuitively this looks to me like a valid proof, I accept it. Mathematician number two says, well, I'm sorry to disagree with you, but I have different intuitions, I don't think it is valid. And Russell's thought is, there really should be some rigorous tribunal we could appeal to here. If we're just taking what seems intuitively obvious to us as our foundation for mathematics, then we have no tribunal to appeal to when different people have different intuitions.
Given that the Russell project was to turn mathematics into logic, and given that 1 plus 1 equals 2 is something that everybody listening to the programme will intuitively think is right, how did he tackle that to turn it into logic?
Right, so Russell thinks that if he can give a definition of the number 1 and a definition of the operation plus 1, then he'll be able to prove, using the rules of logic alone, that 1 plus 1 really does equal 2. You'll no longer have to accept it as basic. So Russell gives definitions of the numbers using things he calls classes, and this enables him to complete this project.
I want to ask you at this stage, Anthony Grayling, something that Mike mentioned, that being influenced by idealism when he went to
to Cambridge, which it seems to be the right thing for everyone to be influenced by when they go to university, especially from such a restricted background. He turned against it towards an extreme form of realism, influenced by the Austrian philosopher, I read here, Alexius Meinong. So why did he believe that, and what did he find there? You've had an introduction to it from my...
Yes, he did indeed go from one extreme to the other, from idealism to a very, very extreme form of realism, premised on the idea that if things we say seem meaningful to us, it must be because the expressions in what we say that refer to things actually have something to refer to. If you think that nouns, the meaning of a noun is the object that it denotes, then since you can talk about unicorns and fairies, there must in some sense be unicorns and fairies in order for that term to denote them. So if I say fairies don't exist, then in some sense there must be fairies in order for me to be able to say of them that they don't exist. This is a very, very extreme form of realism. This was Meinong's theory, and Meinong said, well, obviously, of course, we don't really want there to be fairies jumping about at the bottom of the garden, so what we have to think of in their case is that they don't fully exist, but they subsist. There's a kind of second-class existence that they have which enables us to talk about them. And that was the view that Russell adopted. And very amusingly, a much later philosopher, W.V. Quine, described this as Meinong's ontological slum, meaning that the universe was crammed with objects, subsisting objects, just in virtue of the fact that we could talk about them.
Mike Beeney, Russell's moving through different ideas at this early stage in his life. And another fashionable idea at the time is known as monism, which was associated with F.H. Bradley at Oxford, across the country. What's monism, and why did Russell argue against it?
So monism is the view that there's only one ultimate reality, and it's particularly characteristic of Bradley's idealism. Bradley thought that everything was sort of interrelated in one whole, and that whenever we try to kind of conceptualize something or separate out something in thought, we kind of distort it. And Russell thought that in the case of asymmetrical relationships, you couldn't actually reduce them away in the way that Bradley thought. So he came to the conclusion, this is another illustration of what Anthony Grayling thought, that relations had to be understood as separately existing entities, so that when we talk about X being larger than Y, there's X, there's Y, they're independent, and then there's a relation that's also independent. So he adopted a kind of form of pluralism, which was in opposition to Bradley's form of monism.
Is this some sort of contest going on for the high ground of philosophy? Did Russell's view prevail at that time?
I think it took a while for it to prevail, but I think the most important thing that happened, you mentioned it earlier, so I should say a little bit about that, is Russell's meeting with Peano, the Italian mathematician and logician in 1900. So he attended a congress in Rome, and what Peano taught him was the new logic that he and a German mathematician called Gottlob Frege had started to develop. And you mentioned in your introductory remarks that Russell later said this was the high point in his intellectual life. And I think what Russell realised was this new form of logic, which was far more powerful than any logic that had hitherto been available, gave him the resources to solve some of the contradictions, problems that he'd seen in idealism. And it's from that point on that he started to use the new logic to try and solve these problems.
Now, here we go, we're turning to classes and to Russell paradox and so here. So here we go. Bertrand Russell wanted to reduce mathematics by logic using something he called classes. Can you explain what he meant by classes and why this was important?
Sure. So classes are the sort of things that modern mathematicians use the word set for. So intuitively speaking, the idea is for any collection of objects that you care to name, there's going to be a set whose members are precisely those objects.
Bottles.
Yeah, for instance. So your bottle and your cup, there's a set that contains just those two objects and no more. If people are objects too, then there's a set that contains you, me, Mike and Anthony and nothing else. In this theory of sets, sets themselves count as objects, so this is important for Russell. So we can now iterate the process. We can consider higher level sets which themselves have sets as members. So I could form, for example, the set that has precisely one member, and here's the member that it has, the set that contains your bottle and nothing else. So Russell's idea is, okay, let's try identifying numbers 0, 1, 2, etc. with particular classes, and maybe this will allow us to execute the logicist program we were talking about earlier. So Russell says, in the case of the number 3, for instance, I'm going to define the number 3 to be a particular set. here's the set we're going to define it as. Ready? So it's going to be a set whose members are themselves sets, and the sets we're talking about are sets containing precisely three members. So one member of the number three would be the set containing you and Mike and Anthony and nothing else. Another member of the number three would be the set containing the set that contains your bottle and nothing else, the set that contains your cup and nothing else, and the set that contains your cup and your bottle and nothing else. So the number three on this picture is a set with infinitely many members, and every member is a three-membered set. And the point of all this is, if you've given an explicit definition of the number three in that way, you can then give a corresponding definition of the number two and of the operation plus, and you can use these definitions plus the rules of logic to prove that, for example, 2 plus 3 equals 5, the kind of thing that arithmeticians normally have to just take for granted.
Mike, can you, before you come in, I think that one or two of our listeners might be saying to themselves, so where does this lead to?
I just want to add one thing to tie it back to the idea that mathematics is logic. So the key idea here is that we actually make use of logical concepts. So if you take the concept of being identical with itself, which is often taken as a logical concept, and we also think of negation as a logical concept, so we have the concept not identical with itself. So then we consider, what is
can
it
you give, I'm sorry to be so lumping about all this, but could you give us an example?
Well, we consider the concept not identical with itself, and nothing can be not identical with itself. Everything is at least identical with itself, okay? So right. We consider the set of things that are not identical with itself, and that's nothing. We call it the null set. So essentially that null set is being defined in terms of these logical concepts, not identical with itself. Now we've got our first object, the null set, defined purely logically. This is the idea. We have one object, we can then very roughly say that the number one is, as it were, equivalent, if you like, to that. We've got our first object, so we can use that object defined logically to define the number one. We then have two objects, 0 and 1, which we can use to define number two, and so on. So that's the idea of the logicism.
Well, to get back to your question about what's going on here and why you use these logical notions, I suppose one thing one could say is that intuitively the idea of a group, of a set of objects is much, much clearer and more accessible than the notion of a number. If you ask somebody, what is the number three, or what does the word three denote, you have a much more complicated task than using this more intuitive notion. And then you're using that intuitive notion as part of a definition of number, which doesn't involve any reference to numbers. So you're not using any arithmetical concepts at all, but you're using logical concepts and explaining what the arithmetical concepts are in logical terms.
Henry, do you want to add to this?
Sure, no, I mean, I just endorse all those comments. I mean, I was telling you the story about which object the number three ends up being on this story so that we can see where we end up at the end of the day. But Mike and Anthony are exactly right. It's a crucial part of the story for the purposes of Russell's project that there is another way of getting there that starts from just logical notions. So we don't have the notion of number sitting there undefined at the very foundations anymore.
Anthony Grayling, Russell attempted to reduce mathematical logic. You've been talking about that, you three. Then something came up called Russell's paradox, which caused him a lot of problems and lots of other people problems, a man to repudiate a lifetime's work, according to another great philosopher and so on. Can you tell us what Russell's paradox was, and then the three of you discuss it?
Basically, the idea is that Russell, using the notion of a class, which, as Hilary pointed out, is now referred to as a set, but using this notion, he came across the difficulty that some classes are members of themselves. For example, a class is, in being a class, is a member of the class of classes. And there are some classes which are not members of themselves. So, for example, if you had a class of, let us say,
horses,
a horse is not a class. So you get this distinction between kinds of classes or types of classes. And he came across the puzzle that what would you say of a class which was not a member of itself? If you had a class of all those classes that were not members of themselves, would that class be a member of itself or not?
What is a class not being member of it,
member of itself actually mean? Could you give us an illustration?
Well, again, if we fast forward it, we give a very clear illustration, which is that you might perhaps arbitrarily define classes as occupying different sort of levels, and you might say that a level 2 class is only allowed to have level 1 classes as members, and it can't be a member of itself. I mean, a very good example of a class that would be a member of itself is a class which is a member of the class of classes. And in virtue of being a class, it would be a member of the class of classes. The paradox that he came across is very similar to this. It's not exactly the same, so one mustn't be misled by the analogy, but it's a little bit like this because it makes it easier to understand. Supposing you have a barber in a mountain village who shaves just those men, all and only those men, who don't shave themselves. So if a man in that village doesn't shave himself, he's shaved by the barber. Now our puzzle is, does the barber shave himself or not? Because if he doesn't, then he's part of the group who doesn't shave themselves and who's shaved by the barber. So if he doesn't shave himself, then he does. And if he does shave himself, then he doesn't. So this is the paradox. If he shaves all and only the men who shave themselves, then he both does and doesn't shave himself. And this is an analogy of the problem that Russell detected, which is, what happens if you have a class of classes which are not members of themselves? If it isn't a member of itself, then by definition it is. And if it is, then it isn't. And that's the paradox.
Mike Beeny, can you take that into the effect it had on others, particularly on the German philosopher Gottlob Frege?
Right, so Gottlob Frege was a logicist 20 years or so before Bertrand Russell, so we often think of him as the first logicist. He was a logicist about arithmetic rather than geometry. And he certainly thought, before Russell, that you could define the numbers in terms of, he called them extensions of concepts, which were essentially sets or classes. And for Bertrand Russell, for Gottlob Frege, Russell's paradox was in fact a serious problem, because in his account, just like Russell realised, he did want to talk about classes being members of themselves. This is how you used to generate the natural number sequence defined as classes. So Bertrand Russell wrote to Frege in 1902, just as Frege was publishing the second volume of his great work, The Basic Laws of Arithmetic, when he was hoping to show that arithmetic could be reduced to logic. And Frege immediately realised that this was devastating. He wrote back and said, "Oh, the foundations of my project are completely shattered. I don't know what to do." I mean, he tried in an appendix to the second volume of his work to respond to it, but in fact we now know that doesn't work. And in fact, Frege ended up having to give up his logicist project, and he concentrated on developing his logical and philosophical ideas instead, and left it to Russell to try and resolve the paradox.
Russell blew up his own work as well as Frege's work, but what was it resolved, Hilary Grimes?
Was it resolved? So Russell himself went on, so in 1903 he has Principles of Mathematics. This is his first attempt at logicism, but this is the version that falls to the Russell paradox for precisely the same reasons, more or less, that Frege's version of logicism falls to the Russell paradox. Russell's response was somewhat more robust than Frege's. He said, okay, we've obviously got a serious problem here. Our system is infected with paradox at the very foundations, so clearly we can't reduce arithmetic to logic in the particular way we've been trying to so far. But maybe we can start again and do it in a more careful way that will avoid this paradox. So this is what Russell spends most of the next 10 years of his life doing, rewriting the logicist project on more secure foundations.
And does he succeed?
Yes and no.
Right. Silly of me not to realise that was an answer. But what were the secure foundations that he thought he'd found?
So Russell developed something that he calls type theory. And here the idea is, he takes a step back and looks at the Russell paradox and tries to arrive at a diagnosis of how we managed to end up with a paradox here. And Russell's thought is, okay, the reason we've got this paradox is that in the, let's call it, naive set theory that we've been using so far, we have permitted a certain kind of self-reference. So we started talking about the class of all classes that aren't members of themselves. And Russell thinks, okay, the reason we've incurred a problem is that when we do that, in some sense by saying the class of all classes that aren't members of themselves, we're presupposing that all the classes are already there laid out. But then we're using that notion to define another class, the class of all classes that aren't members of themselves, and we want it to be the case that that new class we've just defined itself ends up being a member of the collection that was supposed to be there in the first place. So Russell thinks this is where we've gone wrong. What we need to do is write down a foundational theory that forbids that kind of self-reference, and if we can do that, we'll rebuild arithmetic based on these new foundations, and that's what he proceeds to do with his theory of types.
So just I'll add one thing just very, very quickly. So Frege thought that one could talk very naively, if you like, about all objects, where this includes classes as well as everyday objects. And one thing that the theory of types suggests is that actually we need to sort of have a hierarchy of objects. So there's ground level objects, there's classes of those objects, there's classes of those objects, and you can't treat classes higher up as somehow members of classes low down. So that makes us think that actually the world of objects is actually more structured and complicated than we originally thought. And I think this has been quite influential in philosophy since, that we can't just think there's a simple domain of all objects, but we have to actually try and sort out what kinds of objects they are and what their relationships are.
Let's turn to the theory of descriptions, which is arguably Russell's most famous idea, Antony Grayling. Can you explain what that is?
It's a theory that comes out of the early commitment Russell made to the idea that the meaning of a word is the object it denotes. This was what he acquired from Meinong's view about the nature of meaning. It's not a very good theory of meaning, by the way, but it prompted this this rather interesting attempt to solve a difficulty. And the difficulty is the over-rich universe of things that you get if every meaningful expression it must have something out there that it denotes. So what Russell did was to say, actually, most of the words that we think of as denoting or naming objects in the world are not really denoting expressions. They're really disguised descriptions of those things. And there are only two, or perhaps if you take the plurals of them, four, words that directly denote. And these two words are the demonstrative pronouns this and that, and the reason why they are guaranteed to refer to something is that whenever you use a demonstrative pronoun, as you get from the actual label of it, you're demonstrating, you're pointing at the thing that you're talking about. This is a glass of water, or that is a microphone. All the other expressions, all the other nouns and names, disappear when you look at the underlying logical structure of the sentence in question. The example that he used was, the present king of France is bald. Now, supposing there not to be a king of France at present, if you said the present king of France is bald, you feel that because there isn't a king of France, that sentence must be false. But in what way is it false? Well, first one has to remind oneself of the fact that what Russell wanted was that our language, like our logic, should be, in the technical term, bivalent. That is, have only two truth values, true and false. And if it isn't true, then it's false. If it isn't false, then it's true. And in the case of a sentence like the present king of France is bald, it seems a bit difficult to know how to explain its falsity, given that it looks a bit like a complex question. You can't say either yes or no. You've got to unravel some implications or presuppositions anyway of that question. What he did therefore was to say a sentence like the present king of France is bald is actually three sentences when you dig down into its underlying form. And the three sentences are: there is a king of France. Anything whatever which has the property of being king of France is identical to that thing. And that rather complicated little utterance takes care of the definite article the, which seems to imply uniqueness. And the third one is, whatever that thing is, it is bald. So you have, there is a king of France, anything else that's king of France is identical with that thing, and that thing is bald. And that is the theory of descriptions. It shows that the apparent subject expression in a sentence is in fact a description. Now, the example I've given you, the present king of France, that is a description. If I were to say Louis, meaning the person who's king of France, is bald, then it would turn out that Louis, an apparent name, can be analysed into there is something X such that X has the property of being Louis. Anything whatever that has that property is identical with that thing. And that thing is bald.
Mike Beeney, how important was this in philosophy in general?
Okay, so just taking up, what was really crucial in the theory of descriptions was the contrast that then opens up between grammatical form and logical form. So it looks like the present King of France is bored is a simple subject-predicate proposition saying of something that it has a property, but Russell suggesting that actually it has a far more complex logical form. It's actually made up, as Anthony says, of three sentences. Now, this was immensely important. In a sense, this idea can be generalised. So we can take a lot of sentences that look as if they're about one thing, say, well, actually, they're not. So here's another example to illustrate the idea. So I might say, my wife has three children. We understand what that means. You know who my wife is, perhaps. And you know what it is to have three children. Now, you compare that sentence, which is straightforward, I think, to understand, with the average woman in York, let's say, has 2.2 children. Now, there is no such person as the average woman in York. Maybe a BBC documentary might try and find some such person. But even if you were, there's no way that such a person would have 2.2 children. So when we say something like the average woman has 2.2 children, what we're actually saying is something much more complicated. Namely, if you count up the number of women in York and you count up the number of all their children and you divide the latter by the former, you get the answer 2.2. So we can analyse a sentence, in other words, in such a way that we reveal, as it were, what we're really committed to. There are people living in York, and we can talk about the average woman as a kind of, and this is the term that Russell started to use, a kind of logical fiction or logical construction out of those individual people. Another example might be, we talk about committees. The committee made a certain decision. But of course, a committee as such isn't an entity that makes decisions, it's the individual members of a committee. So the full analysis of, say, a statement such as a committee made a certain decision is, this is what happened at the individual level. And that, I think, opens up a tremendous project of trying to understand what the various sentences that we use mean.
Hilary Graves, Russell also wrote about knowledge. Would you tell us about the distinction he made between different types of knowledge?
Sure. So in the first instance, we have a distinction in the background between two ways in which we use the word knowledge in English. So on the one hand, I can know an object, I can know my brother or your cup of water. On the other hand, I can know truths, I can know that this table has a grey top and so on. So Russell is talking specifically about the first category, knowledge of objects, and he wants to probe further the various ways in which we can have knowledge of objects. One of the things he's reacting against is an idea that he takes the idealist to hold to, which is the idea that really, in order to know any one object, you would have to know literally all the truths there are about that object. So on this account, as Russell understands it, I can't really say that I know you unless I know not only what you look like, but also what your bank account number is and who your paternal grandfather was and so on. So clearly Russell's thinking, well, this is going to lead to the consequence that we don't actually know any object at all. That can't be the full story. What can we say instead? So his idea is, okay, there are two ways that we can know an object that are less demanding than that. The first way applies to objects that we've come into more or less direct contact with. So at a first pass, he would say that I know you by acquaintance because I've met you. But then he thinks, well, there also seems to be a sense in which we know other objects that are more remote from us in the universe, and maybe ones that we haven't come into any direct contact with. So for Russell, an example of this might be, I know David Cameron. But then he thinks, well, hang on, I haven't met David Cameron, so how does this work? And his account of how this works draws on his theory of description. So his idea is, well, sometimes I'm in the position of knowing a certain truth, and the relevant truth here is going to be the truth that one and only one object is the present Prime Minister of Great Britain. So Russell's thought is, okay, if I know that truth, and if in fact, whether I know it or not, David Cameron happens to be the object that satisfies that description, then we'll say that I know David Cameron by description, even though I don't know him by acquaintance, and acquaintance is the direct contact way of knowing objects. So Russell thinks that this distinction has wide-ranging implications, both for the theory of knowledge, the theory of how we know truths, and for the theory of how our words get to refer to items out there in the world.
Anthony Groening.
And because he was an empiricist, he wanted to establish that all the things that we know by description can ultimately be traced back to some things that we know by acquaintance. And this is a very, very important point for him, because despite the fact that he changed his mind and changed his views about how you work out a theory to this effect, right the way through his philosophical career, he was very anxious to show how science, natural science, can ultimately be based on empirical foundations, how you could trace back all the things that we know by description to things that we know by acquaintance.
Can we talk about Russell and language and the influence he had on language more specifically than him? Do you want to start with that, Mike Deaney?
Yes, so the theory of descriptions, I think, is pretty much a basic topic in the philosophy of language. So if someone's studying the philosophy of language, they perhaps start with Frege's famous distinction between sense and reference, but then the theory of descriptions is often seen as one of the most important works in philosophy of language. And I think subsequent to Russell, people start to question whether Russell offers an adequate account of that. So as Anthony said, what's sort of important in the theory of descriptions is that you're saying that there's an important difference between names that stand for objects. The meaning of a name is the object it stands for, and definite descriptions, which are sort of analysed away into a more complicated form. And so there's this fundamental distinction between names and definite descriptions, but along comes other philosophers, and most notably Peter Strawson, writing in 1915, says, well, hold on a minute, we have to recognise that actually names and definite descriptions in many ways function the same way. They both seek to refer to something. So what Anthony's identified as the first two sentences in a proper analysis of the present King of France's board is actually sort of taken for granted. It's presupposed rather than something that we're actually asserting when we say that the present King of France is bald. And the most important thing is that we're identifying, we're using the definite description to pick out an object and then saying something about it. So Strawson comes along later and says, well, I don't buy this distinction that you're making out between names and definite descriptions. So it starts up a whole discussion about the relationship between those two kinds of expressions.
Hilary Graves.
Well, I think we can usefully identify three rather distinct ways in which Russell's theory of descriptions was influential. So, I mean, the first one is, as we've said, it's still accepted today. We now teach it to our first year students as basically the right way to understand sentences that start with the word the. The second point also we've already seen, Mike mentioned that Russell's approach to the theory of descriptions introduced some new tools which then had applications very much more widely within philosophy of language. So we saw the distinction between grammatical form and logical form, and Russell pointing out the way in which if you don't pay attention to this, you will be led astray. But then the more broad methodological point is Russell's approach to the theory of descriptions is widely regarded as an absolute paradigm of what we now call analytic philosophy, which Russell more or less invented. So the idea here is we are definitely still interested in the big questions. So as with Russell's theory of descriptions, there one of the main motivations was let's try and get clear on whether there's any sense in which fairies exist, or whether on the other hand we can get away without saying they exist at all. We're still interested in those matters that are themselves beyond the domain of language, so it's certainly not the case that we're just talking about words. On the other hand, Russell's approach to descriptions illustrates the fact that if we don't pay very careful attention to how language works, we will be led astray in our thinking about those non-linguistic questions. So that combination of a focus on the big questions with approaching them via careful attention to language very much characterises the creed of 20th and indeed 21st century analytic philosophy. But lots of people look to Russell as the originator and the model for this new method.
That's right, and very important philosophical ideas have part of their importance in the reactions that they provoke, the disagreements they provoke. For example, Ludwig Wittgenstein, who had been a pupil of Russell's before the First World War in Cambridge, in his later philosophy, Wittgenstein's later philosophy, reacted very sharply to the idea that language has underlying logical structure which requires analysis. Instead, he thought that meanings lie in the surface of language and in the uses, in particular, that we make of them, and that we mislead ourselves, in fact, if we think that there is something that we have to unearth. And interestingly, in Wittgenstein's earlier philosophy, expressed in the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which was written pretty well out of the encounter that he had with Russell, he has an even more radical view of a denotative theory of meaning where names denote objects. More radical and more systematic than Russell's own early view on this. But then there was a kind of complete reversal of view in Wittgenstein's later work, and you can see Wittgenstein's later work as being a major reaction to this idea that underlies the whole approach in analytic philosophy.
We haven't talked about a great deal that he did in the political sphere and in the popularising sphere and in the broadcasting sphere. What would you think his legacy was then, Hilary Graves?
Well, I think the reason Russell is still an inspiration to so many of us today is that he combines absolute rigour and clarity with taking on just about every topic that there is. So you've mentioned he was widely involved in social and political affairs throughout his life. He also wrote several books on ethics. Russell himself thought of ethics as not really part of philosophy and sharply separated it from his philosophical work. But I think lots of us would say we don't have to take that part of Russell on board. We will take him as a model of somebody who applies clarity, rigour, logical reasoning to every topic you care to name. So in other words, we don't have to go down the route that some people criticise some parts of academia for today, of sacrificing the wider view in the interest of narrow specialism and being able to do one thing very well. Russell did everything, but did all of it very well.
Mike Greeney.
So I think in terms of within philosophy, then, the theory of description in particular was enormously influential. I think without Russell, we simply wouldn't have analytic philosophy in the way that we recognise it. But also, he did write a number of popular books. I suppose the most important, I think it was the best-selling book, was his History of Western Philosophy, which must have introduced tens of thousands of people to philosophy. It introduced me, for example. It's a book that I read as a student, read as a school child, and decided I needed to do philosophy because of it. But I think looking back on that now, I think that Russell rather caricatures the views that he talks about, but there's no doubt that he had this ability to give nice accounts, often witty and sometimes sarcastic, sometimes caricatures of the philosophers that he tackled, and I think that's been quite influential, and people have enjoyed reading Russell. I think he makes philosophy exciting and something that they want to think about and work on.
Finally, Anthony Graham.
Well, Russell writes wonderfully well, and he is very witty, as Mike says, and that's a great help. But I think he actually had a massive impact, in a way, on social thinking. He was politically engaged all his life. Before the First World War, he stood for Parliament and on behalf of women's suffrage, the votes for women. In the 20s, he stood as a Labour candidate in elections. He was very committed in the First World War to pacifism. In the 50s and 60s, of course, was energetically opposed to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So he was a very engaged intellectual. His writings on popular subjects, especially on things like marriage, divorce, sexual morality, they were, I think, part of the story that needs to be told about how, after the Second World War, and especially in the 1960s, there was a great liberalisation of outlook. And he is one of the presences, really, in that story. Without it, without his book, especially Marriage and Morals, which was cited in his Nobel Prize award, we might not have moved with quite the celerity that we did to our more tolerant age.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Hilary Graves, A.C. Grayling, Mike Beeney. Next week, we'll be talking about the 1,000-year-old Persian epic poem Shahnameh of Ferdowsi. Thank you very much.
There are many more Radio 4 arts and discussion programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.